Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. The historian Fred Logaval has written a grand, fresh take on the life of John F. Kennedy as if to reignite an old flame. Not least, Fred, you're giving us a chance to remember politics as the sport of great minds and hearts, high language, serious stuff.
For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
JFK was so much more than the 35th President of the United States. Heroic in war, killed in office, perfect model of reckless manhood, invented royalty, public vigor, private pain and illness, uncounted brushes with death, an unfinished story even now. But you've told it so well, Fred, in this first of two volumes. Remind us what drove you to tell it anew. You, Swedish-born, Pulitzer Prize historian of the war in Vietnam.
But what we don't have, I believe, is a full-fledged, it's strange to say, but a full-fledged biography that is a true kind of life and times effort that puts this extraordinary life in this rather amazing half century. Because you think about 1917 to 1963 and all that goes on, I didn't think anybody had really tackled it in that way. And moreover, the sources now are so amazing, including down the street at the Kennedy Library, that I thought this is the time to do this.
The parallelism of JFK's life and the birth of a colossus here in the United States, I mean, they're so beautifully entwined. And you may be right, it's not been told that way before. But in every wave of JFK books, Fred, some big secret is revealed. Yeah. His sex life or his awful string of illnesses, his brushes with death, many of them. And it seems to me you break a big secret here, which is that John F. Kennedy was a serious man, incredibly well-prepared, well-read, a prodigious reader. He told baby brother Ted, never be without a book in your hand. He was a writer of consequence. His mind is turning over big questions. He may be thinking about girls, but he's turning over big questions every day of his life, every hour of his day, it seems.
Yeah, no, this was one of the things that really struck me in the research. I mean, again, the materials are so fabulous. We don't have a lot of papers from his days at Choate, his prep school, but we have a few. We certainly have a sizable number of papers from his Harvard years. What they show me, Chris, and what the letters, in fact, the letters are really
incredible.
What they show me is indeed somebody who is, from an early point, interested in major questions, serious questions. Mm-hmm. He's worried about, as are many other people, democracy in the second half of the 1930s. Can it survive? Under what circumstances are we going to be able to confront these threats that we face? Can we do so? I see this from an early point, and I do think it's something that previous biographies, important though they can be, and they do illuminate various parts of his life, I think they've missed this. It's there from an early point. He's a serious guy who treats serious things seriously.
I like that resonance with our own worries today about the survival of democracy. It was a different question for him, but related. I see JFK as a teenager reading on his sickbed at boarding school big books like Winston Churchill's three-volume Life of the First Duke of Marlborough. That's Kennedy to me. You write that he had the kind of exposure and training that no future president since John Quincy Adams had enjoyed at so young an age. Not FDR, certainly.
I think it's true. I think it's pretty remarkable that the Churchill books, also his multi-volume history of the First World War, this kid is devouring these books and wants more of them and gets more of them. And he's especially fascinated by European history and statecraft. I think it helps to explain how he's then drawn to European questions and concerns. I think this connection to Churchill totally fascinates me because his father could never understand the appeal of Churchill. Whereas I think Jack saw a great historian, but also somebody who had a gift for the written word, a gift for oratory, and I think on some level at least he wanted to model himself. I don't want to make the connection too close, but I think he saw in Churchill somebody to whom he could look as a kind of inspirational figure, and I think that's a fascinating part of the story.
Yeah, I've just discovered that Winston Churchill wrote that Life of Marlborough through the 30s. He's in exile politically, but he's writing his own present life into this 17th century giant of British military politics.
Yeah, and it's a million words. I mean, this is a huge undertaking, and yet it doesn't seem to faze the young Jack.
It's meat for him. He is serious about many things. Friendship, for sure. Family, literature, life, death, history. He's playful and careless and insatiable about sex, not so sure about love. He's trained in Catholicism and a lot of the old wisdom, but he's deadly serious about politics.
Yeah. Yeah, he is.
A call to duty, really.
I think it's exactly right. And, you know, one of the reasons I think he's drawn to politics and he loves politics is precisely because he thinks it's so important. The example of his grandfather on his mother's side, Honey Fitz, legendary Boston figure, I think he's close to him, even though they become very different kinds of politicians.
Yep.
He's nevertheless very close to his grandfather. He drifts toward, both at Choate, but especially at Harvard, the study of government. This is a guy who, I think, feels the importance of government and of politics from an early point.
Mm.
And it's one of the reasons why, Chris, I'm skeptical that on this, counterfactual question, suppose Joe Jr. comes back from World War II alive, I'm skeptical of the common assertion that, well, Jack would never have entered politics because it would have been closed to him because Joe Jr. was destined for that path. I don't doubt that Joe Jr. was the one who was going to get first crack at this, but I have a feeling that sooner or later we would have seen Jack Kennedy also enter politics. It was really important to him. It was something that completely fascinated him. And I think he became convinced, having published his senior thesis to wide acclaim, having served in the Second World War, having then covered international politics at the end of the war, I think he was convinced by 1945, 46, I can do this. I can contribute to the great debates of our time, and I'm going to seek political office.
Can I just add, after the Kennedy assassination, I made a little project as a young reporter of getting to know all the guys that ran his first campaign in 1946. Mm. Joe Kane, Clem Norton, Billy Sutton, Mark Dalton, a whole variety of them. Incredibly fun, interesting guys. Joe Kane had been with Peter Tagg against John F. Fitzgerald. He had been part of the force that threw John F. Fitzgerald out of the Congress in 1918. He used to say, yep, helped grandpa out, helped grandson in. He would say he set up the fight for JFK, which meant planting candidates in each of the districts, like Cambridge and Charlestown, to take off the local vote, etc. But what I got from them was that, A, they just adore John Kennedy, but that he worked so hard. He was relentless. Yeah. The day would end late at night at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. He'd go in for supper, but he would always ask, have we done everything?
The point that you're making, I think, is deeply important. I think a secret of John F. Kennedy's success at every level of politics. So when he runs for the House in 46, when he takes on the mighty Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. in 52 for the Senate, and then when he seeks the Democratic nomination in 60 and then takes on Nixon in the fall, I think a secret is that he starts earlier and then works harder than his opposition. And I think there's ample evidence of this.
In one of those YouTube vignettes that I love to look at late at night, JFK at a party in Jim Cannon's house, Ben Bradley is there and his wife, family, and they ask him, why are you running for president? What's so great? And he says, would I want to be a lawyer doing wills for old men, divorce cases? Are you kidding? But he says, from the very beginning, meaning 46, it was hard, hard work. Get in early. It was long, long labor. It's fascinating. He knew he had dedicated himself entirely to that craft.
Why do you do it now? Why do you go all this effort? Obviously, you were a well-to-do guy who could live off the fat of the land. Why do you go in for politics? Well, look now, you went to law school, and then I go as I become a member of a big firm. And I'm dealing with some dead deceased man's estate, or I'm perhaps fighting in a divorce case. You tell me that that compares in interest of being a member of Congress and trying to write a labor bill and trying to make a speech on foreign policy? I mean, I just think that there is no comparison.
Under the heading of seriousness, got to note that from college days, JFK is hugely serious about the place of the U.S. in the world. He'd had a long running argument with his father and his older brother Joe about intervention, U.S. intervention in Europe in 1940. Father and brother were against it. Hitler was too far along. England was unprepared. The United States couldn't save it. JFK then and later was arguing, no, the United States had to be at the center of power in the world from now on. It's a doctrine he was beginning to repent, I think, in his final speech at the American University in Washington. Something had happened. But that is the sort of serious drama in his head all the time, I think. Where is the United States?
Yeah. Oh, I think so. And I think one of the things that I found utterly fascinating about this story is that, you know, the Harvard student body in 1939-40, so this is his senior year at Harvard, the student body turns out to be incredibly isolationist or non-interventionist. Mm-hmm. And this is revealed in surveys that the Crimson did, and we have ample evidence to suggest that the faculty was more interventionist, the students much less so. And yet, during the course of that year, we see a gradual split between father and son, not between father and first son. As you point out, Joe Jr. was in lockstep with his father throughout, really until he was killed in 44. But Jack, in the course of writing his senior thesis, in the course of, you know, immersion in his studies, interactions with professors, begins to say, now, wait a minute. I think perhaps this Fortress America notion is untenable for this country. And so you see, to some degree, even in the thesis and in the book that follows immediately after, more so perhaps as a result of his own experience in the South Pacific, but yes, this guy comes back from the war convinced that the United States must assume, must have a leadership position in world affairs, and it's very different from his father, because his father, even after the war, is an isolationist, and the two of them disagree quite profoundly, which interested me.
Coming up, the ancient Greek wisdom that character is destiny, and how JFK's got formed. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Fred Logaval has given us 650 pages of prelude to John Kennedy's presidency, how his character was formed by extremes of wealth and warfare at sea, by deep reading through a sickly boyhood, by demanding parents and 8 siblings. He was never to be mistaken for a spoiled brat.
JFK and his siblings grew up in great privilege. It's not that they were spoiled. They actually didn't get big allowances. The houses were rather ordinary in terms of the furnishings and so forth. But there was a message that I think the parents, to their everlasting credit, imparted on these kids, which is that you need to do something with your life and you need to give something back. Rose Kennedy, who is often, I think, slighted, at least to a degree, in the scholarship or in the books, Rose, the mom, deserves real credit for instilling in her second son this respect for history and this interest in politics and also this sense that he should be doing something with his life. And so I think that's there, and I think it's really important. The debates that he takes part in at Harvard, I think, also are an important part of this story. And I think the senior thesis is a real boost for him in terms of his self-confidence. This is a serious study that he produces, I'm convinced, very much by himself, although he has help from his father's aides in London who send him lots of materials about British appeasement. That's the topic of the thesis. So he gets assistance that sort of an ordinary Harvard student wouldn't get, but nevertheless, this is his work.
It's the part of the book and of JFK that I like most, Fred. It's his effort as a 20-year-old kid, 21-year-old kid, to dope out a sort of four-dimensional chess game that's going on in front of him. How to explain that England chose not to rearm when Hitler was building his war machine? JFK made it a puzzle about democracy. Why did isolationist, understandably war-weary England, US too, not see the danger? And why did the top politicians, especially Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain, why did they not override public opinion with what they knew? To me, it was JFK at his best, cannily getting into the heads of elected politicians who had failed awfully at measuring grave military danger and figured out the popular politics of facing that reality.
He's interested both in structure and in human agency. That is to say, he on some level wants to suggest that the individual leaders, Baldwin and Chamberlain, are not so much responsible for this state of affairs, that it had much more to do with popular opinion and an aversion to war because of memories of World War I, interest groups in British society that were also determined not to waste precious resources on rearmament. And yet he also feels the need, and this happens maybe especially in those quick revisions between thesis and book, feels the need to say, well, you know what? Chamberlain also bears responsibility for this. Chamberlain did not understand the nature of the Nazi threat. He was unwilling to see where things were going. But that tension within young JFK, age right. 22, 23, between how to view this in structural terms versus the role of individual leaders, I think is completely fascinating.
To me, it's the heart of his formation or malformation for the presidency. He was facing something like that test as president, looking at Vietnam, and I would say he failed it. The question in the late 30s in Europe and the early 60s in China were related in this sense. It was all about calibrating military and diplomatic strategy for a democracy that doesn't have a lot of facts or a lot of argument to steer by. What is the duty of an elected leader? And you write in your book, it was a conundrum that JFK would confront to the end of his days. When the time came, he couldn't bring himself to say what he knew, that whatever happened in Vietnam, it was not a vital threat to American interests, and that France had lost her colonial war, and there was no way the United States was going to win it.
The young JFK, when he visits Indochina in 1951 with Bobby and Patricia, he sees through what the French are trying to do, and he sees the futility of trying by military means to thwart Ho Chi Minh's revolution. He also says more broadly at various times in 1951 that it can't simply be about communism versus anti-communism. We have to meet the needs of people in the developing world where they are, where they live. And I think he always maintains that skepticism about military solutions to these things. And yet, here's the paradox. As president, starting in 61, and maybe especially in 62, he expands U.S. involvement quite dramatically to support the South Vietnamese. I have to crack that particular nut in this next volume.
I concluded that JFK was a far better political and military analyst in Why England Slept in 1940 than he was in the White House in 1961, looking at Indochina.
Part of the answer to this puzzle, I think, is quite simply domestic politics, that I think John F. Kennedy feels, like other Democrats in particular, that they are vulnerable to charges of being soft on communism. And so they don't want Republicans to be able to use that particular club against them. Some part of him says, I've got to keep the patient alive. I cannot be seen as the one who lost South Vietnam here.
Right.
Of course, LBJ is going to make a version of the same argument. But I think it's, at least in part, the perceived pressures. I think he felt the safe course here. I'm a savvy politician. I'm shrewd about these things. The safe course is to somehow stay the course and hope for the best.
But this is precisely what he saw and criticized in Stanley Baldwin and Evelyn Chamberlain. They didn't have whatever to stand up to the people and say, I know World War I is still in our minds, but this is serious and we've got to rearm. And Kennedy understood that they had failed there. I think Kennedy at his best, for example, would have punctuated the domino theory that Eisenhower left, the idea that Ho Chi Minh's Vietnam had to be a pawn of China and we had to stand up. When in fact, the Vietnamese had been fending off China for centuries, Chinese bullying, and as Kennedy said, the South Vietnamese government had lost the sympathy of its people. case closed. And he said that pretty much in 1954 in this wonderful clip you sent me.
Indochina is an ancient French colony. And even though the French have made gradual concessions to the people, their control is still paramount. And therefore, the communists under Ho Chi Minh are able to claim that they are fighting for independence, and the French appear to be fighting for a maintenance of colonial rule. I therefore believe that before the United States moves in any degree, that independence must be granted to the people, that the people must support the struggle, because unless, as I said, that support is forthcoming, any intervention by the United States is bound to be futile.
Yeah, and you know, on the domino theory, it just speaks to the point we're making here. On the domino theory, he can say in a televised interview, I think it was maybe with David Brinkley or maybe Cronkite, late in his life, last 3-4 months of his life, when asked, do you believe in the domino theory? He says, yes, I believe it. Whereas privately we know, he didn't really. He understood that it was way too mechanistic, that in fact, and we have evidence of this, that you know, he understood that whether a country, quote-unquote, falls to communism depends on the conditions within that country. It's not about what happens next door. Kennedy understood this. I think he, in many instances, refused to act on the basis of the domino theory. So, for example, in Laos, his advisors are saying to him, Mr. President, we need to send combat troops to Laos. He says, I'm not going to do that. So there are mysteries here.
Mysteries. Fred Loggeval, for sure, and secrets, too. Let's go back to those elements of an extraordinary childhood that formed him. He's a sickly boy. He's in pain all his life. People said, maybe, Bobby, he had a raven on his shoulder. And early on, he's got this favorite poem of his, I Have a Rendezvous with Death, by the World War I poet Alan Seeger, father of Pete Seeger, I discover. What does that matter?
I think one of the things it does is it gives him a certain empathetic understanding. And we see a great example of that understanding in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So to jump ahead to near the end of his life, I think he's able to put himself in Khrushchev's shoes. He's able to see things from Khrushchev's perspective, which I think helps us get a non-violent solution to that extraordinary crisis. I think his ailments, maybe it's a little similar to what FDR experienced with polio, that I think they made Kennedy, at least in terms of cognitive empathy, we can bracket and we can talk about it, emotional empathy and whether he had that to the same degree. But in terms of being able to see things from other people's perspective, I think that's one thing that happens as a result of these ailments that you describe. I think another thing that happens, Chris, is that it convinces young Jack Kennedy. The fact that he's sick so much and is in fact on his deathbed more than once, I think it convinces him that he's got to live each day to the fullest. And I think it fuels him in a way that maybe somebody who's been healthy wouldn't feel to the same degree. But as I said before, I also don't want to exaggerate how important these ailments are. I think when it comes to his legendary Kennedy energy, even in the South Pacific, his mates talk about how hard he worked as a commander of PT-109 and more generally. That happens in spite of these ailments.
Yeah, it's all connected. I mean, he was turned down for the Army, didn't pass his physical. The Navy had doubts. And yet this is the guy who swims to save his crew 5-6 hours through the middle of the night, towing his engineer, McMahon. It's one of the incredible goosebump stories of endurance, of energy, of dedication, of selflessness that I've ever read.
I so agree. And in writing that chapter of the book, I thought, well, you know, this has been told a lot. And of course, I have to do this, but I'm not going to learn that much from doing this, perhaps. On the contrary, I found it just a mesmerizing story, the evidence that I accumulated in describing what he did. I don't think anybody, or at least I would not call him heroic for allowing his boat to be rammed. But in terms of what happens in those 6-7 days after the encounter, after the ramming, it's something else. And I think, you know, the best evidence for his actions or for how to interpret his actions is that his crew members, to a person, both at the time, so this is not just oral histories years later, but in terms of their letters home and in terms of what they said at the time, had nothing but praise for this guy.
It was also Norman Mailer's point of entry into a sort of a novelist's stab at something infinitely deep. He took a crack at that picture, and he wondered whether JFK was courting disaster in his PT boat when it got hit. Norman Mailer asked, was he a man who senses death within him and gambles that he can cure it by risking his life? A man whose resentment and ambition are too large for his body? And he goes on to say about the finale, this is Mailer, it is not so very many men who have the apocalyptic sense that heroism is the first doctor.
Oh, it's powerful. It's really powerful. I think there could be something to this. And I also wonder if some of the same kind of thinking fuels Joe Jr. in 1944 to volunteer for what I would call a suicide mission. It was an extremely dangerous mission from England in the sort of, not maybe the dying days of the war, but certainly it was clear by then what was happening. And moreover, Joe Jr. could have just returned home to the United States. But he chooses to pursue this final fatal mission. The plane explodes in midair. Turns out to have been a completely useless mission. That was made clear just a few weeks later. Yeah, you wonder about that, or I do.
On the matter of his formation, on the flip side, the sex, the pleasure, the abandon, the joy of being Jack Kennedy, the pleasure of his company, as Red Fay called it in the title of a book. Incredible self-assurance, daring, candor, among other things that was out of control with women, but it also opened him to his gay pal from Choate days, Lem Billings.
I think it's to Jack Kennedy's credit that, you know, he continues with this friendship, and it's really his closest friend right down to the end in Dallas. That matters to him. His male friendships, I think, were important to him. Jackie found it difficult, to say the least, that he was so close to three or four or five male friends. And you know, the relationship with women is different. And I struggled with this. It's clear that he is his father's son. Joe Sr. makes quite obvious to both Joe Jr. and Jack that he expects them, really demands that they follow in his footsteps. And he would bring mistresses home in the 20s. He would have innumerable affairs then and in the 30s, which of course the boys and the rest of the kids observed. But I also know that I can't have it both ways, because if I'm going to say on the one hand, Chris, that Jack is his own man when it comes to career choices, when it comes to his political views, his worldview, that is to say, he's able to break free from his father on those things. He could have broken free with his father on this and treated women differently than he did. And he chose really not to do so.
Let's talk about his relationship with his father, who was maybe the richest Catholic in America, full-time philanderer, who loved one of the great queens of Hollywood, Gloria Swanson, but also thought of his own family and his nine kids as his legacy, really his work of art. And FDR, no less, acknowledged it. They didn't like each other, Roosevelt and Kennedy, Joe Kennedy, but he more than once acknowledged an incredible accomplishment in Joe Kennedy and his kids, which Roosevelt failed. But there's so much love in those letters from father to sons, careful, steady, intelligent guidance that also leaves room for them to make up their own minds. But there's so much manipulation too.
Yeah. No, there is. And the letters are just unbelievable. I just want to underscore for people that the Joe Kennedy papers available at the Kennedy Library are an absolute goldmine. And they reveal a great deal. And among other things, they show that whatever his complexities, whatever his flaws, and they were innumerable, Joe Kennedy Sr. was incredibly devoted to the kids. And I find it amazing that when he is heading up relatively major government agencies in Washington in the middle of the Depression, somehow this guy finds time in the evenings, I guess it's probably in the evenings, to pen these letters to his children, and especially to the older ones. And he's urging Jack, for example, at Choate, to put in more effort in his studies,
right,
reminding him of what's required if he's going to make something of himself as a citizen. And at the same time, also says to them in various ways, I'm not going to insist that you follow my line. You're going to make up your own minds about how you feel about things. I think that's powerful.
Right. He even says you don't have to be a success. And then there's that wonderful letter he writes to Lem Billings, just saying, you're welcome in our house anytime, your family. It's just, it's very, very touching. At the same time, I mean, I think there's so much more to know about Joe Kennedy. There are lots of passages in your book, Fred, that made Papa really the star and the driver of the whole story.
Yeah. I mean, it's to a degree that I didn't anticipate when I started this. It's not a biography of Joe Kennedy, but he looms. I felt like he had to loom really large.
And what a hustler. I mean, what audacity. He's having an affair with, off and on, with Claire Booth Luce. At the same time, he's lobbying her husband, Time Inc., Henry Luce, for plugs in Time magazine and to get John Hersey's account of PT-109 into Life magazine. He didn't want it in the New Yorker. He wanted it in the the popular picture book.
And he lobbies Henry Luce to write the foreword, while the affair is still going on, the foreword to Why England Slept. Unbelievable.
Coming up, the mind of John Kennedy and its imprint on the writer of his biography and on us readers. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source with the Swedish-born biographer of John F. Kennedy, Fredrik Lögvall. I'm wondering if we can still call his alluring subject A Man for All Seasons, or the deepest tragedy of 20th century America?
I think for me, in terms of thinking about his legacy, it's because of what we discussed earlier, that he took serious things seriously, that he believed in democracy, and that American democracy, for all of its flaws, which I think he perceived, this was an extraordinary experiment. He reminds us of an age when it was possible to believe that politics could solve big things. And I think it's, of course, exemplified in this extraordinary inaugural address. But what's interesting about the inaugural address is that so many of the themes in that address you can see in his early speeches, many of which he wrote himself, including in the 1946 congressional campaign. This notion of don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. He's articulated those kinds of themes before, and also about the danger of being cynical about politics and what democracy requires. They're there throughout his political career.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Those are the themes that inspired or certainly persuaded my brothers and me. I mean, that's why we thought he was a god in the 60s and long after. And still I'm wondering, what was the core of his thinking? To me, he wanted to bring rationality and not expertise, but good thinking, history, to public life. That was a big calling. You couldn't say his legacy is the space program, although he started it. It wasn't civil rights, although he spoke up when he had to. I would have said, reading back from the American University speech, that peace was always the core of his thinking and goal. Although in office, he went at it by indirection and maybe too late. He didn't get there quite with Khrushchev and the Soviet Union, and he didn't quite get there with Castro either. But speak of peace, the Peace Corps.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the takeaways for him after the Pacific War, after he returned from the Solomons, is that the military instrument was unlikely to achieve for society and for the United States in particular what leaders thought. I think he came away dubious because of what he had seen his superiors do in the South Pacific, and even what the top leadership, FDR and others, had decided. I think he came away skeptical of seeking military solutions to political problems. I think that was always there. I think when you then enter a nuclear age, I think this is reinforced. And I think he believed in the fall of 62 during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but really to the end, that war is an impossibility, must be an impossibility, especially war between major powers in this nuclear age. And as I think in that respect, I think the American University speech, you're absolutely right. It represents a kind of, what's the word? A kind of crowning achievement. And it's part of his most important legacy, that speech, which we should read again and again for what it tells us about his thinking, about where the world is. This is, what, 6 or 8 months after the missile crisis. And there's also a sense, of course, about what might have been. Was it the case that the Cold War was winding down in those final months of Kennedy's life, that he and Khrushchev had reached a kind of tacit understanding?
Right.
And then that was lost, partly lost because of the escalation in Vietnam, developments later on. We won't know.
This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
He spells out that we've got to get to know the Russians anew, and he reminds the Americans that if the United States had lost comparably what the Russians lost in World War II, everything from Chicago north and east would have been a parking lot. And they lost 30, 40, 50 million souls. We lost 600,000, and we had to readjust. Also, that final line, or as he said in the final analysis, we are citizens of a small planet, we breathe the same air, we cherish our children, and we are mortal.
Yeah. He had studied Churchill's speeches, he had studied Lincoln's speeches, he was forever in awe of the Gettysburg Address and how Lincoln in 275 words could accomplish what he did. So that's part of this. But, you know, the other thing to note about the American University speech is if you go back and look at other speeches, for example, a speech in Seattle in the fall of 61, so this is what, a year and a half earlier, little remembered today, in which he basically says, you know, there are problems in this world that we, the United States, can't solve. And we make up a small percentage of the world's population. There is a limit to the power that we have in world affairs. He talks even then about the need for diplomacy, the need for seeking negotiated solutions, for not assuming that we have the answers to all the world's problems. That's important. You could even look, it seems to me, at the inaugural address, which is often seen as a kind of Cold War call to arms.
Right.
But in which he also says that, you know, we can't be afraid to negotiate. In which he says that civility is not a sign of weakness. It's, in fact, I think, a much more measured inaugural address and was perceived by the press, by the way, at the time, as a conciliatory speech.
Right.
We don't remember it as a conciliatory speech, but it was.
Well, I find it totally fascinating that in that line about we must never negotiate out of fear, but we must never fear to negotiate, that's an echo of his old argument with his father about Hitler. His father was saying, we got to talk to Hitler, but we don't want to blow up Europe and half a million American lives doing it. His father felt there were all sorts of opportunities to delay, to negotiate, to work something out with Germany. And JFK was at least saying, you know, we're going to talk these things out, and we're not going to be afraid to talk them out.
I think it's a really good point that you make. And I don't know that I've seen others draw that kind of connection. It should be drawn. And I want to draw it in volume two. And moreover, here we could also look to Joe Kennedy Sr. in, say, 1946, 1947, when the Cold War is beginning, and he and Jack are on opposite sides on so many of these early decisions by Truman. Joe is saying, the Soviets are not out to invade anybody. Stalin understands just how weak he is. The last thing he wants to do is to invade Western Europe. This means, according to Joe, that the United States can take its time. It can look to see what's possible in terms of diplomacy, etc. More than a few Cold War historians, I think, would agree with Joe Kennedy's assessment. And as you point out, we see echoes of this in his son's speeches as president. So there's a certain, maybe, I'm only thinking about this for the first time, maybe there's a certain reconvergence, if you will, between their positions right here toward the end of Jack's life.
I'm wondering why Democratic candidates and politicians since Kennedy have had such a hard time reproducing his effect. Jimmy Carter borrowed a little bit of the Navy officer. Bill Clinton had that wonderful picture of himself at Boys Nation, 16 years old, shaking JFK's hand. Ronald Reagan was a different sort of Sinatra pal and showbiz figure. Barack Obama certainly cut his own figure of brainy, almost royalty. And yet that mind and that urgency of JFK, where's it gone?
Yeah, I puzzle over this. It's clear that many candidates on the Democratic side have tried to be a new version of JFK. The fellow who shares his initials, John Kerry, certainly wanted to adopt some of the mannerisms, even some of the phraseology of JFK. And I too wonder about what it is. I mean, one of the, I think, understated secrets of JFK's success is that he was not, I don't think he was particularly partisan, but I think he succeeded. And moreover, I would say we should remember that he too presided over a divided America. I think we sometimes forget that it was more of a fringe in those days, but there was certainly an element in American society that thought of JFK as the Antichrist, that thought that this was a disaster for the country, that were deeply opposed to him. In his very last speech, or a speech he never got a chance to give, scheduled for the Dallas Trade March on November 22nd, 1963, he talked about the importance of reason and reasoning from argument. And if we Americans, don't follow reason in our debates, then there's going to be hell to pay, he said in so many words. And so this point that he was on, in some ways, above politics.
Yeah, you're right.
That's critical.
I'm so glad you mentioned John Kerry among the politicians who traded on something of the JFK appeal, the Navy record, but I think it was Kennedy's example that made it so easy for John Kerry, right out of Yale, to volunteer for service in Vietnam. But it all makes you realize how tough an act it was for JFK to pull off, and he did it.
Yeah. John F. Kennedy had immense gifts. He had an understanding of politics from a lifetime of study. There was a charismatic appeal. One of the things that's interesting, even about the first campaign in 46, and aides would comment on this, Chris. People would say, you know, to meet John F. Kennedy, this young 29-year-old, to meet him is to like him.
Right.
And they just saw that there was something about this young guy, untested, inexperienced, that made you want to support him, that made you want to work for him. He always had way more volunteers in all of his campaigns than they knew what to do with. There was something there that I think other politicians haven't been able to, with some rare exceptions, haven't been able to find.
Isn't it strange, Fred? Here we are talking about the most seductive, most glamorous, literally most beautiful political player in a game that is turned more repellent and almost hopeless as we speak. Glamour in politics? Are you kidding? And yet, the ages of the 60s and now are somehow connected. I don't know how to do it, but through decades of disenchantment.
I don't know if it's centrism or a kind of moderation in politics. I can imagine listeners right now are saying, well, how quaint, how naive, the divisions are so deep. But at some point, I think we have to return to this. I think that an understanding, and this comes through in Kennedy's book. We haven't talked about Profiles in Courage.
No.
But I think the book is really quite interesting in this regard, because he talks here about the need for compromise, calling it really the essence of democracy. And I think people, a lot of Americans understand that, and they want to come back to that.
Yeah. Fred, I want to ask you on the personal side about your life as a biographer. You've been a straight historian to this point. I'm thinking of the late marvelous biographer Robert Richardson with that trifecta of books on Henry David Thoreau, Emerson, and William James. He wrote about this art of biography later in his life. And I thought of you when I caught up with it. He had learned that life writing should be gripping, vital, and intense, while giving a sense of the person's daily existence that links, here's the key part, that links the reader's life with the subject's. I think he felt, after a half a lifetime doing this sort of thing, that it had been his education in himself. He said, it's an art that, for the writer and the reader, tells us that we need not be passive victims of what we deterministically call circumstances, that we can become freer to be ourselves, to be what we most want and value. He observed the lives unfolding and took it into himself. Do you have that experience of this, 10-year immersion in the life of John Kennedy?
I don't know. I guess maybe it's the shy Swede in me coming out that makes me reticent to talk in depth about how this has affected me. What I can tell you is that I think it's such a strong point that he makes about that linking the reader's life with the subject's. And I have thought in writing Volume 1, and I will certainly do this in Volume 2, that it's critically important that I want to give the reader a sense of what it was like to be in JFK's shoes, to live in that era, to face, at least to some extent, even if the circumstances are really different, some of these choices that he faced. I think it's absolutely key for a biographer. This is my first attempt at a biography. I'm a historian by training. I'm trying to bring the historian's perspective to this. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to put this into its wider context. I think for me, though, maybe to go to the heart of your question, I do think I understand what I'm doing here on this earth, why I'm doing it better as a result of being immersed in this extraordinary life. And I think this sense that Kennedy gives, and he talks about this with friends, so it's not just a sense, this is actually articulated by him, that we don't know what the future holds, that life is capricious, life is fraught. What I'm going to do, therefore, is I'm going to live, you know, each day to the fullest. He says this to Torby McDonald. He says it, I think, to Lem Billings, to others, to George Smathers. I think about that a lot. And I think on some level, I think it has affected how I view my own existence.
Fred Logoval, I cannot thank you enough for bringing this story alive, which is to say, I'm talking to all those characters and I feel they're talking to me. It's a marvelous book, JFK, Coming of Age in the American Century, 1917 to 1956, Volume 1, Can't Wait for 2. Fred Logoval, thank you.
Chris, thanks so much for having me on. It's just been a pleasure.
You can support Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you will find extra extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series of interviews about storytelling in a time of social distance. This week, he's talking about Arthur Conan Doyle with the comedian Lauren Lapkus. Find the conversation at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Max Liebman engineered. Mary McGrath is our model of Irish-American royalty. I'm Christopher Lighton. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.